All right, so just a few words of explanation. There are actually several effects that are mixed up in this figure, which is why the illusion is so powerful. So one effect is I think it's called simultaneous contrast, and that's simply that when you the perceived lightness of a patch like this is somewhat dependent on its surroundings. So because this is surrounded by light squares, it may seem darker, tend to be perceived as darker than it actually is. Since this patch is surrounded by darker patches, it may be perceived to be lighter than it actually is. And so sometimes that illusion is shown by itself, a light square, a gray square with a dark background, and a gray square with a light background. And although the grays are the same inside, they actually look a little bit different. And that kind of phenomenon can be somewhat explained by this lateral inhibition story, right? It's just that neighboring lightness is computed by taking differences between the patch you're looking at and neighboring patches. But this illusion is much stronger than the simple simultaneous contrast illusion, and the reason is because also this shadow, right? This shadow here. This is the issue of how to remember. I told you about reflectance and illumination. How do you distinguish changes in the light that you're receiving from the changes in lightness that you're seeing could be due to changes in the paint or changes in the illumination. For example, this shadow could have just been painted on by somebody. Right? It's not really clear that it's being cast by this. Right? So your visual system decides that this is a shadow. One of the cues is that this is a very a diffuse edge right here. It's a very gradual edge, whereas these edges right here are sharp. And so one of the stories that visual psychologists tell is that often sharp differences we attribute to real differences in reflectance, whereas slow differences like this we attribute to differences in illumination. So your visual system infers that this is a shadow, both from this sharpness right here, but also from the high-level knowledge that this cylinder is right here. Right? So that makes it even more powerful illusion. So there's a number of effects that are going on. And certainly, this is the highest level. If the cylinder is really influencing your percept, that will be very high level information that's interfering, not like the center surround thing. All right. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to go and cover some of the mathematics of these networks and try to explain how feedback works. So Larry talked yesterday about these networks with global inhibition and also lateral excitation. And so the difference here between here and this morning is that I'll emphasize more excitation. So this morning was much more about the power of lateral inhibition to do things. And I want to say a little bit about excitation. Let me make one caveat here. I told you about the retina in limulus. And you might ask, well, there are center surround cells in the vertebrate retina also, your retina. Does the center surround structure in the vertebrate retina come from this lateral inhibition, this inhibitory connection? And actually, the mechanism is quite different, and I'm not going to have time to get into that. But don't go jumping to conclusions and think that what I told you this morning is actually an account of what happens in the vertebrate retina. So I don't have time to get into that. I'm going to go on and try to analyze in more detail the type of models that Larry talked about yesterday. So before I do the analysis of the models, let's see how to do this. All right, I do need the board for this, actually. Can someone black that out? So Larry told you about models where there's some kind of set of neurons with a topographic organization, something like this. So the preferred orientation or spatial position would vary. in some systematic way across this set of neurons. So imagine they're all receiving some inputs. All right, and suppose there's some global inhibitory neuron right here. So that inhibitory neuron is receiving signals from all the excitatory neurons, and it's summing up all those influences, and it's giving back inhibition like this. All right, so that's the global inhibition. And then Larry talked about some lateral excitation. So he imagined that this neuron would excite its neighbors and excite the nearest neighbors more strongly than the neighbors that are farther away. So it's kind of like the lateral inhibition case, except I told you in Limulus that the inhibitory influences tend to be weak and then strong and then fall off with distance again. So Larry talked about a case where the excitatory influences would fall off with distance. Now that's a more complicated, that's a fairly complicated case to analyze. So I'm going to start out with a simple case, and I'm going to ask you to consider the case where there's only self-excitation. So each of these neurons feeds back to itself like this. And we're not going to consider any lateral interaction. All right, so some people may say, well, this seems rather unrealistic. How often do neurons excite themselves like this? It's not really clear whether this is a realistic model of adult brain, but in fact, it has been discovered, at least in juvenile animals, that these autapses, synapses that go from a neuron back to itself, autapses are fairly common, at least in the developing brain. So it's not a complete figment of a theorist's imagination. All right. Okay, so self-excitation and global inhibition, and let's write down some network equations. We will write down something like this. So the strength of the self-inhibition is going to be alpha. And I'm taking these connections, the connections from the excitatory neurons to the inhibitory neurons, they're all 1. Just I've scaled out some strength, right? And then the connection back is called beta. Right? So Y sums up the influences of all the excitatory neurons, and it returns an inhibitory term that looks like this. Right? And it's global, right? For all the I's, a global inhibitory signal is felt. All right, could I have the projector again? So, this is just a numerical simulation of that dynamics. And what's plotted here, I think it's 10 neurons, and so what's plotted here are the activities, the x's, all x1 through x10. That's what this bar graph is. And this is b1 through b10, so all the excitatory neurons are receiving some input, which is, as you can see, varies with the neuron index. And down here I have several parameters that I can control. Alpha is the strength of the self-excitation, beta is the strength of the inhibition, and tau, I've taken tau of the excitation to be 1, and so this is really this is the time constant of the inhibition relative to the time constant of the excitation. So it's right now they're equal, tau is equal to 1. So I took tau e equal to 1, and tau, this is tau I in these equations, tau I. right, so let's just start out now with alpha equal to, 0.8. And every time I press this button, I can randomize the inputs. I'll just randomize the inputs each time. And so this is a graph of the 10 excitatory activities as a function of time. Running graph. And so every time I press that, this settles back to some fixed point right here. And you can kind of discern a pattern. The neurons that are active at the fixed point are the neurons that receive, in this case, these three neurons here are the top three neurons that had the top three inputs, the largest three inputs. And the neurons with smaller inputs don't respond at all. So that happens every time the top few inputs, it's not a constant number that actually end up being selected. Right, in this case, it's only one that's active. Now, alpha determines how selective this network is. If I reduce alpha, if I reduce the self-excitation, then more neurons are allowed to be above threshold. And if I increase alpha, then the network becomes more selective, and only only one neuron in this case is allowed to be above threshold. Okay, so. In this case, it doesn't depend on the initial conditions. Let's see if I can randomize the initial conditions. So, that's an important point, that this network doesn't have any multi-stability, that for a given input, it always produces the same output, irrespective of initial conditions. I haven't proven that for you. I've just given you a little empirical evidence for that. But that's actually the kind of thing from a mathematical theory, we'd actually like to know. Under what in a linear network, we know one input is going to give one output. Now, nonlinearity might give us a multistability, where one input can give rise to more than one output. So how important is nonlinearity in this? So we'd like to have a mathematical theory that tells us that. I don't think that you can have that, right? Because some neurons are below threshold because they're being inhibited. And neurons can't be inhibited until one of them is actually above threshold. All right. So it's this funny thing about recurrent inhibition. Yeah, question? That's right. That's right. The only nonlinearity that we have, this is a threshold linear system. I'm going to show you some tricks that we can use. It's piecewise linear, so we can actually kind of divide it up into linear regimes and analyze it. That's what's nice about the whole this particular choice of the nonlinearity. So I told you that, in the general form of the neural net equations, there's this F of something, which is describing the input-output relationship of the neuron. And one of the things that was omitted from these lectures was to actually show you that relationship for many real biophysical, real neurons as measured in experiments or biophysically realistic models. And so it often is the case that if you take a neuron and you inject it with current, that there might be some, So if we inject current and we look at the rate, there often is a very linear regime. Something funny might happen around here at the beginning, and eventually there's some saturation, but often there's a very substantial linear regime. And so this is a reasonable approximation. And it has the advantage that it's analytically somewhat tractable because it's piecewise linear. All right. A lot of things can happen here. If alpha, it turns out that alpha equals 1 is a critical value. So if alpha is greater than 1, and I'll try to prove this for you later, if alpha is greater than 1, then no matter what happens, only one neuron can be active at the fixed point. So no matter what we do, only one neuron can be active. All right, I've just shown you a few examples. But you could play with this a lot. I mean, it turns out alpha really is a critical value. Below alpha, what happens is that sometimes one neuron will be on. So basically what's happening is that if alpha is less than 1, if the number of neurons that is going to that are on at the fixed point depends on how closely spaced these top inputs are. If the input, the two neurons, is extremely close together, then it's possible to get more than one neuron on. But if there's a large gap between them, then maybe only one neuron will win. So how many neurons end up winning here in the alpha less than 1 regime depends on the details of the input. How different are the different inputs? But for alpha greater than 1, there's only a single neuron on at the end. And the question that Misha asked, which was multi-stability, can it depend on initial conditions? It turns out in this case it can depend on initial conditions. All right. And the most dramatic example of that, of course, is if I uniformize the input. All right. Let's say I make the input uniform and I randomize. Is it going to work?
Sometimes the fact that you have only 18, 4 bits in
E15. I could speed up tau inhibition, and it might be faster. But let's actually do that. So the network really wants to have one neuron active, no matter what. And even if you put an exactly uniform input, it does that. And if we do it again, well, clearly this is now a totally permutation symmetric situation, right? So there's no reason that we should end up with the same fixed point. And clearly, if one fixed point is with one of the neurons on, that could be and could have been any of the neurons at the end, depending on the initial conditions. All right. Okay. All right. So I'm not going to wait, but it seems like this is going to be the winner, right? All right. So let's take alpha less than 1. So if alpha is less than 1. A symmetric input produces a symmetric output. So there's only one stable solution. Alpha is greater than 1, you can have more than one stable solution. All right, and so remember yesterday, Larry talked about this case with the more complicated network with lateral excitation, that if you put on a uniform input, you can have this bump of activity that sits anywhere on the ring, right? And so this is the analog of that. That if I make the feedback strong, if alpha is strong, then I'll get a case where there's multi-stability. Now there's other stuff. If I make alpha really large, Oh, in fact, my program doesn't allow me to do something terrible to the network. But if you make alpha larger than 2, oh, it's working. It's not just larger than 2. It depends on tau. Sorry. All right. If you make the model, if you make alpha large, it can there's a potential to just blow up without limit, and there's also a potential for oscillatory behavior. So, when inhibition actually has a finite time scale, then let's see if it's going to come down again. Gee. All right, I haven't found the right parameter regime here, but you can actually make it so that if, oh, it has to be greater than 1.5 in this case. All right. Yeah, my scales are not really showing it. But if alpha is sufficiently big, what happens is that the excitation and the inhibition do this, and you get sustained oscillations. You don't get convergence to a fixed point. All right, so let's just go through and try to derive some of these results analytically. And remember that alpha equal to 1 was the boundary line between these two very distinct regimes of behavior. So let's just take alpha less than 1 to start out with. And all right, so at the fixed point, what we got to do is get rid of these time derivatives. So I'm going to analyze the fixed point behavior first. So get rid of x dot and y dot, set them equal to 0. Remember that x can only be positive or 0. So this sum right here actually can only be positive or 0, so we don't actually need this rectification nonlinearity. We can get rid of this. So the fixed point equation looks like the following. All right, so there's only two cases. Either xi is positive or xi is equal to 0. Right? Because the right-hand side of this, if the right-hand side of this is positive, if the argument is positive, then xi is positive. If the argument is negative, then xi is 0. Only two possible cases. So if xi is greater than 0, we simply get rid of the rectification and we obtain xi is equal to bi. And I can rearrange this to make the form all right, just move alpha xi to the left, and I get 1 minus alpha times xi is bi minus the sum, and I divide through by 1 minus alpha, and I get this equation right here. Thank you. All right, and if xi is equal to 0, suppose xi is equal to 0, then I have the equation 0. This is xi equal to 0. Then I have the equation 0 is equal to bi minus beta. Which means that implies that this argument must be less than or equal to 0. So in this case, and also for this to be self-consistent, remember alpha is negative. For this to be self-consistent, remember I have to require that xi be greater than 0. This quantity has to be positive. If this quantity is negative, then this formula is not consistent with this assumption. So if I put both of those together, I end up with the equation right. If this difference is less than 0, then I get xi equal to 0, consistent with this. If this difference is greater than 0, then this equation is satisfied, and everything's self-consistent. Also. This is only true for alpha less than 1, right? Because if alpha is greater than 1, then this being positive makes xi negative, so that's not consistent. So big assumption, alpha less than 1. All right, so this is a formula which is, it's not really a solution yet, right, because xi is still on the right-hand side here. But this is a form that gives you some insight into what's happening. In order to get the output xi, what we're doing is we're taking bi, the input, subtracting off a common threshold. So think about this as a threshold. And it's the same for every neuron. Right, because it came from this global inhibitory neuron. So we take the BIs. The BIs in principle can be very different for each neuron. We subtract off the same quantity from every neuron. We put that through a rectification. So the neurons that are below threshold give a result 0. The neurons that are above threshold can still get through this rectification. And then we multiply by 1 over 1 minus alpha. And so this is like amplification. So remember I showed you that bar graph. I showed you, imagine here's the inputs, bi. So here's neuron 1, neuron 2, neuron 3, and here's b. Somehow there's a threshold which slides up and down according to the dynamics of the feedback. And let's say that it ends up resting right here. So we subtract off this common threshold. Or let's not do that yet. Let's do this case. Let's say the threshold ends up right here. So that means then clearly the output of this neuron will be 0. So now we take this and we cut it off. We throw that away. This is the new level right here. Right? And now multiply everything by 1 over 1 minus alpha. So the result then is, let's say that 1 over 1 minus alpha is 3, then we might end up with something that looks like this. So whatever remains, whatever sticks out above the threshold line gets pumped up, gets amplified. All right? And you probably saw that in the simulations before, that the small difference is if I have two inputs that are very close together in amplitude, once they get stuck through this network, let's say their neurons end up being above threshold, the difference between them is widened. And that's due to the amplification. All All right, so thresholding. Followed by amplification. All right, so the important thing then is we have to really solve this, we have to figure out what is the self-consistent value of the threshold, right? Because once this is all done, we have to sum up all these x's, and the sum of those x's has to go back and fit inside here to determine the self-consistent threshold. So I'm going to assume now that we can order the inputs in this way. Let's just, without loss of generality, we'll just number the inputs so that input number one is the highest, and so on and so forth. I'll assume that the inputs are distinct, so there's no ties. That simplifies the analysis a little bit. Now, from these equations, clearly the only kind of situation I can have is if the first k neurons are active and the last n minus k plus 1 neurons are inactive, right? Because all we're doing is we're taking bi and we're subtracting the same number off all of them. So there's no way, if b3 is off, b4 can't be on. There's no way that can happen. So let's let k, suppose that k neurons are on at the fixed point, then I can simply sum on the left-hand side, summation over I equals 1 to k of xi will be equal to 1 over 1 minus alpha times summation over I times bi minus beta . Okay, what did I do there? Well, I'm only summing over the active neurons, the first k neurons. So for those neurons, I can forget about the rectification. So that's why there's no nonlinearity right here. And in this sum, which is this sum is actually over all the neurons, I can only include 1 through k, because beyond that, all those x's are 0. So now I've ended up with the same sum on the right-hand side and the left-hand side, and that's a closed equation. I can solve that. All right, so the solution then is that I'm not going to go through all the steps, but so that's the common mode gain, right? The average of the inputs of the active neurons, the sum of the inputs of the active neurons, is related to the sum of the outputs of the active neurons by this factor right here. And I did the case before for k, sort of k equals 2, but you see now the k dependence happening right here. Right? This is like somewhat like the limulus curve I showed you before, right? Stimulating one photoreceptor as opposed to stimulating many photoreceptors. So the common mode gain actually depends on how many neurons are activated. All right, so then so now all we know, k is the quantity we don't know. Right? To really solve this equation, to really solve everything, right? I know that once I know k, I can stick this formula inside here, and then I'm done. I'll know what xi is. There won't be any x's on the right-hand side of this. So the crucial thing is determine what k is. Right? So what you have to do then is basically stick this solution back into this equation, all right, and verify that the right number of neurons are actually above threshold. Right? So what I need to have is that bk minus beta times this factor is greater than 0, and bk plus 1 minus this is less than 0. Then, in fact, neuron k will be the last neuron that's on, and all the other neurons will be off above that. So that's sort of determining the edge. Where do we make the cutoff in this series of is this obvious or not? People look mystified. Self-consistent condition for k. In deriving this equation, I assumed that x1 through xk are greater than 0, and xk plus 1 through xn are equal to 0. So now I have to now find the case such that that condition is satisfied by substituting back in this original equation. All right. So again, I'm not going to go through all the math, but the condition is the following. So bk That's the condition. So here's the exercise. Show that this is the consistency condition. What's that? You got to plug that in. Right. I mean, I basically said how to do it. Okay, slightly harder exercise. Prove k exists. And is unique. All right, but yeah, basically, this condition is if I substitute this back into here, then the inside of this argument for I equals k is bk minus beta times this. So that part, it should be easy to show. It's a little bit harder to show that k exists and is unique. All right, so this was the common mode gain. There's another thing that we have to answer. We would like to know, which is the differential mode gain. So, remember, I told you that differences between inputs get amplified. Well, that's not hard to show. If we just take that formula, let's see, where's the formula? Let's take this formula right here. In fact, the original formula. So suppose xi and xj are greater than 0, then I can forget about the rectification in both of these equations. And if I subtract these equations, I get that xi minus xj is equal to bi minus bj plus alpha times xi minus xj. And this common term just cancels out. So the solution then is that xi minus xj is equal to 1 over 1 minus alpha times bi minus bj. So this is the differential mode gain. And that's just what I told you about before, right? That this is the amplification factor, 1 over 1 minus alpha. So any difference between inputs gets multiplied by a factor, 1 over 1 minus alpha. And it's pretty much, because the structure of connections in this network is so simple, that's the only gain. In general, if I have a network of n neurons, I would need n gains, right? There's n eigenvalues, and there's n gains, one for each of the modes. But it turns out there's degeneracy here. All you need is one common mode gain, and then all the differential mode gain, all these differential mode gains are the same for any differences between neurons. And that gain is larger than this gain, right? This k beta term here is reducing the gain for the common mode. Yep.
That gain has to be positive alpha less than 1 plus beta?
Well, we already said alpha had to be less than 1 for this argument to work. So if it's less than 1, it's less than 1 plus beta k. All right, now this equation is not very intuitive, right? It's not really clear in general what happens. How is k determined? Depending on what the configuration of inputs is. I showed you that before. Depending on what the b's are, we might have one winner or one neuron active, two neurons active, three neurons active, and so on. And roughly speaking, the closer the inputs are to each other, the more neurons you might have active. Can we get an intuition for that from this equation? Well, let's suppose that alpha approaches 1. So what I'd like to argue to you is that as alpha goes to 1, we can only end up with one neuron active. Right, and thinking about it this way, as alpha goes to 1, this gain is going to infinity. Something funny is happening at alpha equals to 1. So remember my picture. We have the inputs. We set the threshold to cut off the bottom of the inputs. And then we amplify whatever is on top. Well, if we're amplifying to infinity by multiplying by infinite factor here, that means the threshold has to come up to just below the top of the very largest input. Right? The only, in the case alpha goes to 1, the only self-consistent situation is where this thing, this summation of the x's, is just below this, because this is going to be amplified by such a large amount. And so that means that, indeed, only one neuron can win. And that follows from this. You can show that follows from this, that if alpha is going to 1, then the only solution for this inequality is going to be k equal to 1. And so I'll leave that as an exercise. Okay. There's one thing I didn't check here yet. So I argued that there is, what I did for you now is I took the case alpha less than 1 and I derived the steady state behavior of this network. But I showed there's only one, at least if you believe this condition, you have to prove this, there's really only one steady state generally. But I didn't show that steady state was stable. It could be that there's a steady state, but it's not stable. Right, so we better go and verify stability. So now we'll verify. We'll investigate stability, and this stability analysis will actually be valid for all alpha. However, I'm going to make one simplification. I will assume that tau inhibition goes to zero. So remember, I had these equations. And I'm going to assume that tau inhibition goes to zero so that y instantaneously tracks the summation of xi. So inhibition is instantaneous. There's no low-pass filtering involved there. You can actually calculate. It's more a little bit slightly more complicated to calculate the case where tau is finite. This is a nice simple case. All right. Now we're going to do a local linearization. So let's assume that we've settled at a steady state, and some of these neurons are above threshold, and other neurons are below threshold. And we will only, all we have to do really is analyze the stability matrix of the subset of neurons that are above threshold. Right? For infinitesimal perturbations, all the neurons that are above threshold will remain on, and all the ones that are below threshold will remain off. I'm assuming that none of them are actually on the borderline. Right, so that's the piecewise linear part of it, right? That for linear stability analysis, we'll still remain in the same linear regime that we started out in. So what is the form of the matrix? Let's just put in this right here. I think that yesterday you saw the general form looking like this. And remember, what counts is the eigenvalues of this matrix Wij. So what's Wij looking like? Well, it looks something like this. And so on. So that's W, right? So for there's alpha xi here minus beta xi here, so that's the alpha minus beta term, and then the interactions between I and the x's that are not xj for j not equal to I are minus beta. So all we have to do to analyze stability is to analyze the eigenvalues of this matrix. Another way of writing this matrix is to write it as alpha times the identity minus beta times this, where I'm writing 1 here to be the vector of all 1s. So the outer product of the vector of all 1s with itself is a matrix of all 1s. So this is just another way of writing the same matrix, but in a more compact form. Okay, so how do we diagonalize this matrix? And so in general, depending on how many neurons are active, I could have, this is a K by K matrix. So I need to find out the stability of this matrix. So this is the useful way to write it if you use MATLAB. All right, this is MATLAB thinking. But this is the K by K matrix, and I have to analyze the stability in general for arbitrary K. Right, because we're not sure. In general, we could have differing numbers of neurons active. Okay, so you learned in school about various ways to find eigenvalues. And for a matrix like this, the best method is to guess them. actually, the eigenvectors, right? So clearly, one candidate eigenvalue is going to be the eigenvalue of all 1s. So W applied to the vector of all 1s, if I just multiply this by 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 here, I get a term here, alpha minus beta. I'll get K of them, right? So alpha minus beta, minus beta, minus beta, and so on. So that's one eigenvalue. And then the other eigenvector that's obvious is that if I just take the vector 1 minus 1 here. Right, so what's that? No, I'm using this to be k. So the whole matrix is n. So yeah, this is a good point. So the whole matrix W is going to be n by n. So I should really call this W tilde. That's only the matrix, the submatrix between the active neurons. And so this will be k. Good point. So this is W tilde. So W tilde acting on, say, 1 minus 1 and all the rest zeros, that will give me back alpha times 1 minus 1 and all the rest zeros. All right, because if I put 1 minus 1 here, I'll get out alpha minus beta plus beta, which is alpha. If I put 1 and minus 1 here, I get minus alpha plus beta minus beta. And that's minus alpha. And clearly, there are k minus 1 vectors that I can construct this way. There's a k minus 1 dimensional subspace, which has a degenerate eigenvalue alpha. And so this is just to tell you what I told you before is obvious, right? To remember that 1 over 1 minus lambda is the gain. And so 1 over 1 minus alpha, that's the gain for the differential modes. And 1 over 1 minus this quantity, that's the gain for the common modes. So this is showing you, you know, just the same thing over and over again. All right? So clearly then, if alpha is greater than 1, all right, so first of all, to find instability, we have to have an eigenvalue that's greater than 1. Right? That was the condition that Larry gave yesterday. If there's an eigenvalue that's greater than 1, it overcomes this natural tendency to leak, and there's explosive instability. So this eigenvalue is always greater than that eigenvalue, because beta is positive. So this is always going to be the first one to go unstable. This is the dangerous one. So alpha greater than 1 means unstable. We haven't done it yet. Yeah, that's right. Alpha less than 1, stable. So if there is a steady state and alpha is less than 1, then we know it's stable. If there is a steady state, and we haven't analyzed this case yet, if there's a steady state for alpha greater than 1, then it's unstable.
How come you
show it's stable? Okay. All right, so if there's a steady state, so what I'm arguing is that if there's a steady state for alpha greater than 1, then it's got to be unstable. There's a caveat here. So the instability is in the differential mode. Right? The differential mode means that one neuron going up and the other neuron going down. But if only one neuron is active, if all the other neurons are zero, there's no differential mode. Right? No differential mode. So that means already we know if there's any chance of a stable steady state in the alpha greater than 1 case, it has to be with one neuron on. We can never have a steady state with more than one neuron on. Ahead of time, even before we solve the algebra for the steady states, we know something about the properties of the system because of this. All right, so that explains then. remember, I showed you the simulation. If you put on a uniform input to the system, and alpha is less than 1, you get a uniform output. But I put a uniform input. If alpha is greater than 1, I ended up with one neuron on and the rest off. And why is that? Well, for alpha greater than 1, the uniform output case is still a steady state, but it's unstable. If I initialize the network exactly at that state, it would stay there. But any small noise means that there's a differential mode, and the differential mode will just grow without limit. Well, it will grow until it can't. In this case, it can't grow without limit because eventually the neuron goes below threshold. So you can kind of think about the network operation this way. Differential mode, for alpha greater than 1, differential modes are always unstable. So if I start out with more than one neuron active, I have this happening, but then this neuron hits the bottom, So now k goes down by 1. K was 10 before, now it goes to 9. Then some other differential node grows, and then k goes down to 8. And so on and so forth, until k goes down to 1, and there's no differential node left. Okay, so let's actually solve for what the steady state is. All right, so I told you that the only chance of a steady state, stable steady state, was with one neuron on. So let's try that case out. Suppose that xi is the only neuron on, and we'll take xi equal to bi plus alpha xi, and the rest of the neurons don't contribute anything, so that's just minus beta xi, because the sum over all the x's is just equal to x. Only one neuron's on. So suppose only neuron I is on. Then this equation must hold, and I end up with xi equal to bi Now, you might ask, what happens if alpha is greater than 1 plus beta? Then this becomes a negative quantity multiplying bi. Okay, so if alpha is greater than 1 plus beta, then for positive b, xi turns out to be negative. And that's not consistent with this, with the assumption that xi is greater than 0. Right. And let's see. I think that implies that the solution will grow. It will grow without bound. So alpha. Explosive instability. So why is that? Well, remember that if only one neuron is on, we don't have to worry about the differential mode, but we do have to worry about the common mode. We have to worry about that eigenvalue, and that eigenvalue is alpha minus beta, because k is equal to 1. So if alpha minus beta is greater than 1, then we'll have explosive instability. So this thing will just go up. So there has to be another condition here. We have to have feedback large, but it can't be too large. It has to be less than 1 plus beta, or else we're not going to get a nice fixed point solution. Okay, we still haven't verified. Now, we verified self-consistency of the solution only for that particular neuron, but we have to make sure now that all the other neurons beside this one have enough inhibition so that they're off. Because we have to verify that neuron I is on, but we haven't verified that all the rest are off. So that's not too hard to see. What we have to have then is that, let's see. So suppose, so we have to have that B J. So let's write the equation for the other neurons. The other neurons will be xj is equal to bj plus alpha xj. All right, I'm assuming that xj is 0, right? So xj has to be 0 plus 0 minus beta times xi. So we need this to be true for all j not equal to I. Then I'll have a self-consistent solution. Or in other words, bj is less than beta xi. Let's see if I can get this right. Bj is less than beta xi, which is equal to beta times b. All right, so if for all j not equal to I, this inequality is true, then I'm guaranteed a self-consistent solution. Now, I'm going to use the same notation that I did before. So b1, let's assume that b1 is the largest and bn is the smallest, right? So if b1, since b1 is the largest, if b1 is less than this amount, then I'm guaranteed that b2, b3, and so on will be less than also. So it's sufficient to have the condition. Well, it's sufficient to have the condition b1 less than beta All right, so let's imagine what this means. Let's try to ascertain what this means. What's that? It can be that I is equal to 1.
So this is for I, which is equal to 1.
I think Misha's right that right now I'm worried about the case where I is not equal to 1. Is that right? Right, because I'm looking at this equation for j not equal to I. I didn't say that. I said this. It's not true. It's not true. It's not true. So what I'm trying to derive here is the following. In this case, there's more than one stable state possible. And it turns out that if I look at if I order the neurons in terms of their graded of their inputs, the top few neurons can win. And I'm trying to find the cutoff for that. All right. So it's going to turn out that depending on initial conditions, any of the top few neurons can win. And I'm trying to derive the inequality that governs that. All right. Now, let's now think about how large this number is. So 1 minus alpha plus beta is okay. So this is a positive number, and we assume that alpha is less than 1, or alpha is great. We're assuming that alpha is greater than 1, right? Let me just rearrange this. So let's rearrange this. So bi has got to be greater than so If BI is greater than that, neuron I can win. All right. So this number right here, alpha is greater than 1, so this is a negative number. So the numerator is less than the denominator. So this quantity right here is less than 1. So here's the recipe. Take the largest input, multiply it by a number that's less than 1, say 90%. Then any input that is greater than 90% of the largest input can make its neuron win. All right, and I didn't demonstrate that in the simulations, but with appropriate, that's not to say that the basin of attraction of each fixed point is the same, but it's possible to find initial conditions that will lead to the neuron with a subdominant input to win. All right, so that's the price you pay, that in the alpha less than 1 case, the largest output, the neuron with the largest output always had the largest input, no matter what. In this case, only one neuron can win, but you have the potential for the neuron with the smaller input to win. They're all stable because, yep, they're all stable. They're all stable. Okay, so that's called. This is called multi. This is a multi-stable case. Right, and if all the B's are the same, then that, you know, this condition is basically saying that any of the neurons can win, and that's what I showed you before. Right, so let's try to get some intuition. Remember, the uniform for alpha greater than 1, the uniform state is stable, is unstable, and the basic reason being that any fluctuations around the uniform state will grow; they'll be amplified, and essentially, it kind of makes sense. You've got self-excitation. And you've got lateral inhibition, so that tends to boost, self-excitation would boost up certain things and suppress all the neighbors. So it's going to make differences grow. All right. So the existence of this multiple stable solutions, multi-stability can often be demonstrated experimentally by a hysteresis curve. And so the hysteresis curve, I don't have a demo of that with this model, but the hysteresis curve would involve having two inputs and varying one and varying the other. Let's say you have input number 1, that's constant, vary input number 2 up and down, and see when does the network switch from one state to the other? And that switch will actually occur at different points. And I'll show you a demonstration of hysteresis with a slightly different model. So let's move on. This is a nice model because it's really analytically very tractable. Some people have argued that, for example, let's say you wanted to model a pattern recognition process. At the end, I've got to make a decision between many different inputs. Suppose I've got many different pattern matchers, and they're the inputs of this network. And something at the end has to make a decision to decide which one of those inputs is the largest, which has the best score. Then this network could be the one that does the decision making at the end. All right. But also, it's a nice case where we can analyze the behavior of this network pretty completely. So let's move on to the case where we have not only self-excitation, but suppose that we have nearest neighbor excitation and next nearest neighbor excitation and so on. So we have some spreading. All right, so that would then have, I would have alpha 0 here. Imagine, and I would have alpha 1 here, alpha 2 here, and so on. All right, so let's move on to this case, and I'll show you a simulation of that. Larry actually showed you simulations yesterday. Same, pretty much simple idea. All right, so this has a this has self-excitation, alpha 0, and that's actually here set to 0. It has nearest neighbor excitation, 1.1, and next nearest neighbor excitation, 1.1. This is arranged in a ring, so there's 16 neurons, and they've got this periodic boundary condition. And on the left here is the input, and on the right is the output. All right, here's the phenomenon of symmetry breaking. I'm operating this at a fairly strong excitatory feedback regime. So even, this is what Larry showed yesterday, even in response to a uniform input, we get tuned output. That's pretty similar to what I showed you before, except because we have the lateral excitation, we don't have just one neuron on. We have some spreading of the activity to neighboring neurons. That was the actual traveling that he talked about, right? All right, so here's something kind of interesting. Larry talked about the case where the input was sort of very broad, right? He took a uniform thing and he put on a cosine, a very broadly tuned input. Even if we put on a sharply tuned input, we just stimulate one neuron, we get a profile that looks like this. So it's about five neurons. It's five neurons wide, right? And just intuitively speaking, it's not that surprising, right? The lateral excitation is causing some spreading here. Eventually, the excitation is not enough to compensate for the inhibition, and so the neurons that are farther away are below threshold. So we can play with this. We have linear response. Because this is piecewise, this is a rectification nonlinearity. If I just double b, then I'm going to double. Then doubling x is also a fixed point. All right, so that's pretty simple. Everything that's above threshold is behaving linearly. So you can see that linear behavior right here. Now here's the effect of putting in a background. So the background also pushes up the response right here. That's what Larry talked about, how an input that's nonspecific can actually cause this specific response to be heightened in its amplitude.
Yeah. Background's just adding constant to all the b sub
I. I'm adding a constant to all the b sub i's. And I reduce the foreground. Still remains. Very similar. So here's an interesting question. Why is it that under such a very wide variety of inputs I put into this network, I get out a very similar looking output? Right? We ran into that situation before with the winner-take-all, with this network I talked about before. That's often called the winner-take-all network, with only self-excitation. If alpha was greater than 1, no matter what input I put in, the network always came back with a stereotyped answer, one neuron on. Right? Here, the network is coming back with a stereotyped answer, five neurons on, no matter whether we give it a very broadly tuned input, like the, a broad, you know, even an untuned input, it gives you five neurons. And if I put in something very sharp, I get back something which is still five neurons. So the network response seems outstandingly invariant. And we might like to explain why that is the case. So again, one can go through and do a stability analysis of this kind of matrix. All right, and one thing that you can verify for those particular choices of parameters, if we do a stability analysis for this matrix, if k equals 6, there is instability. If k is 6 or any greater value, there's instability. And if k equals 5, there is no unstable mode. What's that?
This is bizarre.
It depends on the parameters. It depends on the alphas and the beta. Right? It depends on the parameters. So before, what we did is we did a stability analysis, and we found out this case that only one neuron can be active. In this case, it turns out that you can have two neurons active, three neurons active, and so on. But once you get above 5, there is a instability. There's an unstable eigenvalue.
The 5 depends on the
Well, no, it's not purely on that. It does depend somewhat on these parameters too. We can make that wider and we can make it narrower. All right. So remember, the eigenvalues of this matrix are not going to depend just on the connectivity, but they're also going to depend somewhat on the numerical values of these parameters. Why is it 5 in this case? I mean, I don't know. I mean, some of it's parameter dependent, but the point is that we can understand that certain. So the way that I like to put it is the following. So let's consider the general case. So let's suppose that we wanted to solve this for an arbitrary weight matrix. So I would have xi dot. So let's just back up. Imagine you hadn't seen any of that before. Let's just discuss is there a general procedure for finding stable fixed points for this equation, no matter what Wij is? What would be the general procedure if I gave you an arbitrary Wij, not just the one that I gave you here? How would you do it? Well, first let's look for steady states without any regard to stability. Then we look at this equation. All right. And then what we do is we make an ansatz. We say that some set of neurons is on and some set of neurons is off. So I'll have some extra variable, sigma I equals 1. If xi is greater than 0 and sigma I is equal to 0, if xi is equal to 0. So let's just, there's 2 to the n possible sigma configurations of the sigma i's. Choose one sigma I, one configuration of the sigma i's, and then take these equations only for the neurons that are on. And then it's just a set of linear equations, right? If for the neurons that are on, we can just take off the rectification nonlinearity, and I can solve the linear equations just like I did before in these special cases. Once I'm done with solving the linear equations, I go back and I check that the values for xi that I got are consistent with these sigma i's. That's one way that we could solve these equations. It's not particularly efficient, right? Because in principle, I might have to check 2 to the n possible configurations of sigma i's. But I would find all possible steady states. Then the next thing that we have to check is the stability. And to do that, I just look at this, remember this W tilde matrix. Once I've identified a steady state, I look at the submatrix corresponding to the active neurons. I diagonalize it, and I look for the eigenvalues, and I see, are all the eigenvalues stable? Then I'm done. So the interesting thing is that the stability analysis can actually be done without knowing what BI is, just knowing what sigma is. Right? If I tell you these neurons are going to be on, tell me the stability, you'll pick out this submatrix right here, and you'll diagonalize it and tell me whether it's stable or not. So there's 2 to the n possible sigma configurations. And we can divide them into two classes. There are some that are permitted, and there are some that are forbidden. And so what I just told you for that ring network was that for those particular parameters, any contiguous set of neurons that's 6 or more neurons wide constitutes a forbidden set. It can never be realized stably by an input because of the stability properties of the weight matrix. On the other hand, any set 5, 4, 3, or 2, or 1 is permitted. And you can prove a theorem that says that if the weight matrix is stable for that configuration, there always exists some B that will satisfy the conditions and produce that configuration of neurons on. So this is an interesting idea because it gives a way in which the recurrent connections, the lateral connections here, these WIJs, they can actually specify the allowed states of the network. Right, just by the stability properties of submatrices inside W. So I think this is a very interesting idea. And basically, let's actually show that again. So what I'm graphing, right here in this plot, are the eigenvalues. So imagine that we follow this over time. And we look inside that rectification nonlinearity, and we see which neurons have an input that's below threshold and which neurons have an input that's above threshold. So the set of neurons that are actually involved in the feedback of the network is actually fluctuating in time. The submatrix is changing in time. Let's see here. It's too fast. Okay, so you can see that transiently, an eigenvalue will go unstable. Right? So at the fixed point, we have to settle down into a permitted set. And a permitted set means one for which the submatrix has only stable eigenvalues. But transiently, the network might have unstable eigenvalues. Those instabilities are all differential. They all grow like this, and as they grow like this, then some neurons go below threshold until eventually all the instabilities go away. So instability is actually extremely important to the operation of this network. There has to be a transient instability in order to get this kind of behavior. One of the basic properties of the alpha of this, remember the alpha less than one regime was there was no instability in the winner-take-all case. Here there are instabilities. And they're actually constraining the network to only take on possible states. This is actually the eigenvector corresponding to the largest eigenvalue. All right, I didn't actually get into more formal characterization of the stability conditions. there is a condition on W that's required to avoid explosive instability. So remember, in the winner-take-all case, if alpha was greater than 1 plus beta, we got the explosion, where the activity of the neuron goes to infinity. In the general case, there's a more complicated condition that W has to satisfy in order to not get this explosive instability. So there's more mathematics that you can do, but this just gives a general flavor of why these networks behave as they do. Okay, so can you get fewer than 5 neurons? I told you that 5, 4, 3, 2 are all permitted. You can, but you have to make... So I'm not showing it here, but if I imagine that the inputs can also be negative, right, then eventually, if I have inhibitory inputs, I can get it to become narrower. But I can never get it to become wider. Yeah, David?
So I mean, from the stability criteria, I mean this is a claim in some rarefied limit on the architecture of the network. Are there more general claims that one could make on the architecture of the network from the stability, applying stability analysis?
All right. So let me. I didn't actually do anything formal. I'm waving my hands at this point. So, okay. So, what's interesting about this, about these networks? What's interesting about these networks is they use positive feedback, but in a way such that you still have analog response. So, one of the classic examples of a positive feedback circuit in digital electronics is the flip-flop. So this is imagine I take two inverters. This one likes to turn 0 into 1 and turn 1 back into 0. So one stable state is 0, 1, and another stable state is 1, 0. So you can analyze, I think Misha will maybe talk about the dynamics of networks that are very similar to this kind of digital electronics circuit. This is a memory element because it can either be in the 0-1 state or 1-0 state, and we can flip it back and forth. Of course, in reality, these are analog elements. What happens is the following. There is these are the two fixed points, 1-0 and 0-1. But if we initialize the network, if we initialize this circuit at very or close to equal voltage values, we get flow to one of these fixed points. And that's because there's this is like two inhibitions, right? This is like a mutually inhibitory pair. There's a negation happening here and negation happening here. So that's net a positive feedback loop. So positive feedback causes instability. And so things grow. But how does digital electronics deal with this instability? Well, it does it because everything saturates at 0 and 1. Right? So there's 0 volts and there's plus 5 volts. Things can grow in some intermediate regime, but once they reach the rails, they can't grow anymore. So the standard way of using feedback in electronic circuits, positive feedback in electronic circuits, is in a digital regime where you have saturation at both ends. So what's interesting about these...
This is saying you're using an explosive instability, or just all of a sudden some practical aspect of the circuit.
Well, no. Here, what's interesting is that we have explosive instability temporarily, right? But it's... So what I told you about was there are these modes which grow like this, but they can't grow without limit because eventually one neuron hits threshold.
No, I'm saying electronic case.
Oh, well, in the electronic cases, this is a real design, and that's the point of the design, that you're always using the rails to, you're always working at the rails. Explosive instability pushes you there and you stop. But in these networks, what's interesting is that only the lower limit is needed. No upper limit is needed to damp out these transient instabilities. Yep, question?
The
Okay, that's a good question. So for alpha less than 1, you don't lose as much by making the linear approximation, because there is only one solution, and so on. But for alpha greater than 1, you can't get that behavior without nonlinearity. That for no matter for what input you put in, you get only one output on, and multi-stability. Those things you can't get without nonlinearity. All right. So all I'm trying to say here is that what's okay. So the problem with the linear network is that if you have if you start out with an instability, it never goes away. It will just grow without limit. But in the nonlinear network, you can have a transient instability that goes away when one of the neurons gets taken out of the feedback loops. Right? That's why the nonlinearity is crucial. You can't have a transient instability in a linear network. It will just any instability will take you off to infinity. But in a piecewise linear network, you could have some regimes of the state space that have instabilities and other regimes that don't have it. So that's the crucial point. All right. And the interesting aspect of these networks is that you have analog response. You can still have analog response even though there are these transient instabilities, because you don't have the upper limit right there. Actually, let's take a break right now. I've gone on for a while. So let's take a break. How long? I just wanted to show this. I don't really have time to talk about the more mathematics behind the stability theory, but I did want to show this last simulation. This is the case of the same network I showed you before, but now stimulated with two separate stimuli like this. And so the interesting aspect, of course, is that the network response suppresses its response to one of the stimuli, and it does have a response to the other stimulus. All right, and you can see here that this left-hand stimulus has amplitude 0.52, and the right-hand has stimulus 0.5. So this is slightly larger. And it is winning. I think this is a multistable case, but the basin of attraction of this solution is much larger, so you can't get the other solution. Oh, you do. Every now and then you get that solution. We had to try a lot of trials to get it. Okay. So one of the nice ways of detecting bistability is to look for hysteresis. And so let's just do that. So I'm going to increase the stimulus on the right. And we'll see what happened, how far we have to increase it to get the switch. To get it really high. Okay. Switched. All right. So now notice the analog response. This is where it was before. So the input, we're back to exactly the same configuration of inputs we had before, but now we have a different stable state. And let's see how far I have to get it down to switch. Okay. So that's the hysteresis loop, right? I swept one variable up and back down again, and my response if I were to graph the center of mass of that, the center of mass started out at 5, and then it finally went up to here and come back down again. So here's center of mass, and here is right amplitude. So that's the hysteresis loop right there. Okay, so these models are actually quite old. I think the first time this kind of model was proposed was in the late 60s or early 70s, and there people wanted to explain kind of focal attention phenomena. So that I think then experiments on frogs were still fashionable. And if you put a target, if you gave two targets to a frog, then generally the frog would orient towards one of the targets and strike at it. Right? One of the points here is that you could think about this as a kind of memory phenomenon, right? Although in this case, although the input has changed so that this now is stronger than that, the system, because of a memory of the past, still, quote, pays attention to the stimulus right here. So there's some memory effect that goes on when this network is trying to decide what stimulus actually to suppress and what stimulus to let through. So the argument there was that also with frogs you would see this kind of phenomenon, that if once the frog had oriented towards one stimulus, you could put another stimulus in, and it might not actually change until that other stimulus became sufficiently strong. If I don't have the demonstration of that here, but if you start to make these closer together, then you can end up with the averaging case, so that this output pattern is centered in between the two stimuli.
That was also seen with
the frog, that in certain circumstances, if you put two stimuli, the frog would actually strike in between. It would do averaging instead of choosing one. And I don't remember what the conditions were under which they got that.
That was Don Engel.
Engel, right.
Yeah, his flies were the brights at the backs of pencils of bright erasers.
Okay.
And they would be sort of in the binocular region, sort of 15-degree region.
Okay. So sometimes the frogs, and that seemed like a stupid thing for a frog to do, but there was a hand-wavy explanation that maybe sometimes the frog would strike at worms, and what actually got through to its visual system were the tip and the tail of the worm, so it makes sense to strike in between. I don't know. But you can get averaging or decision-making behavior in these kinds of networks depending on the stimulus parameters and the network parameters and so on. All right, so let me just wrap that up. And I want to move on to a different subject, and that's learning. Well, I'm just going to tell you some kind of classical results that people teach in a course on neural networks. They may not necessarily be so biologically relevant, but I'm going to teach you a little bit about representation theory. So one of the questions is, if I have a neural network of some fixed architecture, what functions can I compute with that? Can I compute anything? Right? Is there are there any limits on what can be represented by a neural network with the appropriate architecture? So to do this, I'm going to simplify to the case of a feed-forward network, right? So in general, I told you before that networks have feedback connections and so on, but it's sometimes nice to specialize to the case of a feed-forward network, no feedback loops. And in fact, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to not even consider the complicated multi-layer perceptron that I showed you before, but let's consider a simple perceptron. So pull out one neuron from that artificial neural network, and let's consider what its properties are. So Let's imagine we have a neuron which has output y, and it's got some behavior like this. So this is called the simple perceptron. So that's the idea. We got one neuron, and it's summing its inputs, and so on. Actually, let's take out this. And theta is the threshold. And these are the synaptic weights. And remember what I told you about, many of the things I told you about before can fit in this framework, right? Like the Hubel-Weisel model is just that the X's would be some set of center surround cells. And this perceptron would be taking some linear sum of the outputs of the right center surround cells. And that will be reflected in the structure of W. Right? So linear combination, subtract a threshold, put through some nonlinearity. So one kind of simplification that people make is instead of using f, you could just use a step function. So imagine that we take f, instead of using, say, the threshold nonlinearity, imagine that we used a step function so that f of x F looks like this. And computer scientists like this because then the neuron is a binary element. It just puts out 0 or 1 in response to its inputs. So this is actually a kind of parameterization that people use to build simple pattern classification machines. So back in the 50s, people like Rosenblatt tried to build simple pattern classifiers using this. So in general, this will have some selectivity to different patterns of input x, depending on what w is. Right? The selectivity we saw in the case of the Hubel-Weisel model, that the selectivity of the simple cell to visual patterns had to do with the way the w, these connections were made to center surround cells. So what's the generalization of that? Well, it's pretty simple. There's just geometry, right? This is just a dot product. This is an inner product of two vectors, right? So the dot product of two vectors is just equal to the product of the amplitudes multiplied by the cosine of the angle between them. So if two vectors, other things being equal, if their amplitudes are held fixed, if two vectors have an angle, gee, I've got terrible notation problems. Let's call this phi. Here's w, and here's x, and here's the angle phi. So if phi is close to 0, then this dot product, this inner product w dot x, will be large. And so this neuron would tend to respond, right? If this dot product is large, then it will be likely to be larger than the threshold, in which case the neuron will output a 1. Anything for which this dot product is small, the neuron will output a 0. And it depends, and what large or small is means relative to the threshold right here. Okay. So much, so far so good. Another way of saying it is the following. This is called the separating hyperplane. right? This defines in the space of all x's some hyperplane. And on one side of that hyperplane, w dot x is greater than theta, and the perceptron outputs a 1. And on the other side of the hyperplane, w dot x is less than theta. So in two dimensions, we can write it like this. This is the separating line. And if w looks like this, that line is just perpendicular not a very good 90 degrees here. That line, this is the line w dot x equals theta. So anything on this side will be classified as plus 1, and anything on this side is going to be classified as 0. So according to this viewpoint, a neuron is a device that takes the input space and divides it into two regions that are separated by a straight line or a hyperplane. And one region is classified as positive, and the other region is classified as 0. True or false? It's a little binary decision. Okay, so that's something pretty simple. If you want to be sensitive to a particular pattern x, then what you should do is you should make the weights look like x, other things being equal. Right? If you forget about the amplitudes, w should point in the same direction as x. So in principle, we can make a perceptron that's selective to any kind of feature we want. Right? And that's the generalization of the Hubel-Weisel idea to more complicated patterns than just bars and so on. So in that artificial neural network that I showed you, this is what's happening at every level. Right? At every level, we have some feature selectivity, which is built up like this. Now, we can play with theta, right? If we make theta, depending on what theta is, we can push this dividing line more this way or that way. And so we can make the neuron more selective or less selective, depending on how high the threshold is. All right, so let me give you now a classic example which shows that the perceptron has some representational limits. Not every function can be classified. Now, the question is, if I want to implement some function with a perceptron, does there exist a set of W's for which that's possible? And the classic examples are, so imagine we have x1, x2, and I have x1 and x2. So suppose I want to implement a binary function. So if I have, here are all possible binary inputs. I'm going to make x1 and x2 binary for simplicity also. Although in general they might be real, but let's just take them to be binary. So 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, the only possibilities. If I take the logical AND, I get 0, 0, 0, 1. So can a perceptron implement this? Well, yes, it can. How do we know that? Well, we want 0, 0 to be classified as a negative, as a 0 example. We want 0, 1, 1, 0, and 0, 1 to output a 0. And we want 1, 1 to output a 1. Right? So it's clear I can draw a line that separates all of the 0 points from the 1 point. So perceptron indeed can realize the AND function. Similarly, if I have logical OR, this will be 0, 1, 1, 0. So in that case, what I'd want is I'd want this point to be 1 and this point to be 1 and only a 0 here. And that can be done just by adjusting the threshold. I could draw another hyperplane right here. What's that? Oh, sorry. All right, so both of these functions can be realized. But if I turn this into exclusive OR, right, So exclusive OR looks like this. There's no way that I can draw a straight line that separates the ones from the zeros. So there's no way for perceptron to implement x1 or the logical function xor. So that proves to you by example that there is a representational limit on what a perceptron can compute. What's that? Yes, that's right. So we can generalize the perceptron to make f more complicated. And in that case, we might be able to do this. All right. But what I wanted to tell you was another way of generalizing it, which is to make a more complex architecture than the perceptron. So I'll leave it as an exercise to you to show that you can compute XOR with this architecture. So this is more complicated than the simple perceptron because this actually has two layers of synaptic weights. Simple perceptron had only one. You've got two layers like this. So there actually is a whole little branch of neural network theory, which is approximation theory. You can show that if you have two layers of synaptic weights like this, that you can basically compute any function. You can represent any function if you choose the synaptic weights properly. So there's the idea that these are universal function approximators. All right, I'm being unclear here. So for Boolean functions of Boolean variables, you can exactly realize it. And if you wanted to do real functions, let's say you wanted to have to approximate a real function of real variables, and then you would use an f that's not a Boolean 0, 1, but some sigmoid, let's say, some smooth function, then you can show that any real function of real variables can be approximated by this two-layer architecture. And the quality of the approximation depends on how many units you use in the hidden layer. So if you just allow me to increase this middle layer by as many neurons as I want, I can get closer and closer and closer to any function you want me to. All right, so that's a representation. And I think people have also proved, I don't really know a lot about the approximation literature, but if you take a recurrent neural network and now you choose the synaptic weights properly, you can have that emulate any kind of computer you want to. So they are computation universal devices. So that's the issue of representation. They are, in principle, a powerful class that can, these simple network models can represent arbitrarily complex functions. The other issue is learning. So while I'm assured that there is some setting of the synaptic weights so that I can realize the function, I may not know how to find that set of synaptic weights. Right? These are generally non-constructive proofs that approximation exists. So still we're left with the problem of how to find the synaptic weights such that this network will realize some function. All right, so that's the problem of learning. Well, okay, that's one formulation of the problem of learning. I'll give it to you now. So often called supervised learning. Suppose I'm given some database of input-output pairs, x, y. So I have a database of x, y pairs. And in the case of the artificial neural net that I showed you before, remember the one that recognized hand-printed characters? That database might be images of characters. That will be X. And Y would be the label as provided by some human expert. All right. Now, I want to stress to you that this is not the only formulation of learning. This is one particular formulation. Given a set of examples where the right answer is given by some teacher, some expert, find a setting of the weights of some neural network so that it will give the right answer on these pairs. All right, so I'll have some, let's call it such that FWX is equal to Y. So I'm just writing FWX, right, because you could think about the neural network as a function of X. It spits out a Y, and there are also knobs on it, the W knobs, which you turn in order to get it to do, you want it to you know, if you set the knobs wrong, you won't get this function. But if you set the knobs right, maybe you'll do well. And so the challenge of learning is to find the way to set those knobs on the network. Well, there's many variations. Another kind of paradigm is unsupervised learning. So suppose I give you a lot of data, but I don't actually tell you about any right or wrong answer. Then how do you learn some kind of regularities or structure in that data? Right, a lot of the learning that you do in everyday life is not dependent on somebody telling you right or wrong. Right? So this is really in the case where there's some teacher that's giving you a right answer. All right, I'm not giving you. Maybe I should add. Let's just do this example, and then we can worry about other formulations of learning later. All right. Now, one of the crucial things here, of course, is that you've got examples of functions. So inside my head, I've got a function. I take in hand-printed characters, and I put out a label. It's a very complex function. Nobody knows exactly how to write that function down. If I were a computer scientist building an expert system, I might try to discover what that function is by asking the expert questions. But another way is, well, I'm not going to talk to the expert. I'm just going to have the expert give out a lot of examples of these pairs. And then we're going to try to infer that function from the examples. And so what's crucial here is the issue of generalization. What you can try to do is make the network perform well on the pairs that it were in the training set. But you're not really guaranteed necessarily that the network will perform on examples it never saw before. You could imagine a case where you train the network, it did well on everything it was trained on, but then when you gave it something else, it didn't generalize. I think those of us who are teachers know this experience, right? You teach people something, and you thought you've really taught them so they understood it, but when you give them another example that they haven't seen before, it turns out that what you thought they understood was not actually what they understood. So generalization is a crucial issue here. Okay. So my end goal then is to actually tell you about the backpropagation algorithm for learning in networks. That's the algorithm that was used to train that simulation I showed you from AT&T Bell Labs earlier this morning. So I'm going to try to explain backpropagation. Before I do that, eventually I'm going to explain backpropagation for an arbitrary multilayer perceptron, but let's just do the case of a simple perceptron. So what we'd like is y So we're going to adopt the philosophy, let's adjust the weights W such that this is true for all input-output pairs. So I'm going to add an extra index, let's call it A. Right? Right? So A may go from 1 to M, where M is the number of examples in my training set. And I'd like to choose a W. I'd like to find some setting of the W's for which this is true on all my examples. So one way of doing that is to phrase it as an optimization problem. Right? I write down a cost function. Like this. Clearly, if this cost function is small, then my perceptron is doing really well on the examples in the training set. All right, now, there are many different ways of doing optimization. If you talk with a numerical analyst, right, they'll give you all kinds of sophisticated information. But if you're not too bright, all you do is gradient descent. Right? If you've got a function and you can take its derivative, then just go take a step in the direction of its derivative, right? Because the derivative is the direction of steepest ascent. And if you go minus the gradient, then you will actually go downhill and reduce this function. So the boneheaded thing to do is delta wj is proportional to, let's say equal to, eta times de dwj. Minus sign, where eta is the size, eta is the step size. All right, so here's one very simplistic way of trying to do learning. So let's take this derivative. This derivative will give us minus eta summation over a times YA minus F So I'm just using the chain rule, right? So this is 1/2 Z squared, where Z is this thing right here. And then I've got to take the derivative of Z itself. So I'll acquire a factor of F prime. I'm not going to write that inside part right there yet. And then finally, once I've taken the derivative of F prime, I can take the derivative of the argument of F. And if I take the derivative with respect to wj, I'll just pick up xj. So I pick up xj. There has to be another minus sign because it's y minus this. So the derivative of the inside is minus f prime. So it would really be minus f prime. Now this minus sign canceled out that minus sign. So I'll get eta times f prime times xj. So this particular kind of update rule, changing w this way, so what I would do then is operationally, I would take all my x's, my examples x, put them through the perceptron. So f of this quantity is the actual output of the perceptron. This is the desired output of the perceptron. So take all my examples, find the difference between the desired and the actual outputs of the perceptron, and then multiply that difference by the input, xj, and use that to update synaptic weight delta wj. Wj, because here the goal, remember, is to learn over a long period of time from our examples. So we're actually changing the synaptic connections of the network. Random initial conditions for W. All right. So that's the kind of crucial thing here is this is the error signal, right? If the desired minus the actual is zero, then there's actually no update of W. But if there's an error signal, then we multiply that by the actual input and use the input, use that product to actually adjust W. So this is not really an important factor. F prime is, if F is monotonic, F prime is always positive, and it's the same for all J. So it's not kind of an overall factor. What's happening is that if F, say, looks like this, right? If you're out here where F prime is very small, then changing W doesn't have very much effect on the energy, on the output of the perceptron. So that's what that F prime is coming from. And these things kind of make sense, right? Suppose that the actual output is too small, right? So the desired minus the actual is positive. If the actual output is too small, what we want to do is we want to increase the argument of the perceptron. So we want to make a change in W that increases the inside. Well, if X is positive, then we should make a positive increase in W. If X is negative, we should make a negative increase in W. So indeed, the sign does work out with this weight update. All right. It is a fairly local algorithm in that the weight change for synaptic weight J doesn't have to make use. Okay, so it depends a lot on the input to J. So when I change this weight right here, it's depending on xj directly like this, and it depends on these. It depends on the other inputs only through this total sum, and that total sum is available really over here. Right. So in some sense, you could say, well, this is somewhat biologically plausible in that you have locality. You'll find that the neural network theorists like the idea of locality. That the idea then is that a synapse, when it changes, should only be able to make use of signals that are available on the presynaptic and postsynaptic neuron. And so to a certain extent, that's true here. All right. And you know, that locality is a good criterion generally, although there may be some non-local learning mechanisms in biology. So for example, it could be that chemicals like nitric oxide get spritzed out and diffuse out and actually modulate learning over a broad volume. And then there would be effects that were not local. But it seems like a lot of learning might truly be local.
So the only thing is to calculate the function, we have a data set.
Now the goal is I give you a data set, X and Y pairs, find a W such that your perceptron realizes that function as well as possible.
Okay.
And you do that by minimizing E. So W is really the variable here. That's the variable. X and Y are fixed by your data set. Right. Yes. Yes. That's when you talk about gradient descent, that's in fact one of the strange problems about. You can think about that's why gradient descent actually gets slow when you get close to the answer, close to the minimum. Right, exponential decrease. Okay, so you're worried about the problem of non-uniqueness. Maybe there's more than one solution to this problem, right? So I'm worried about the problem that there's no solution to this problem. If there's more than one solution to this problem and I find one of them, I'm going to be perfectly happy, right? And indeed, there's probably more than one solution to the problem of intelligence. If you look at the wiring in my head and the wiring in your head, it's not the same. But yet we can perform many tasks equally well. All right, so probably with neural networks, in fact, it is very non-unique. All right, we shouldn't worry about non-uniqueness. What we should worry about is whether there's any solution at all that's good. That's the representation issue. And even if there's a solution that's good, can we find it? That's the learning issue. So this function E might have incredible numbers of local minima. In that case, it's hard to find a good solution. Even though we're doing, because we're doing gradient descent, we get stuck. All right, one more operational thing, which is that sometimes, instead of doing this in batch, instead of going through your whole data set and then making a change in the weights, people do this in an online fashion. So this is called a batch update. And the other choice is look at one example, compute this thing, no sum at all, make a wait update. Look at another example, make a wait update, and so on. So that's online. And that's more plausible also, right? You can't, in this case, you actually have to store all your examples in memory, as opposed to learning with each example that comes in. So online update would be just to get rid of this summation. All right, so let me just make it a little more concrete, and I'll show you an implementation of this. So if we wanted to apply this to the handwritten digit problem, one way, we have to choose an output encoding. So one way is the following. Imagine that we have 10 perceptrons, right? And each of them looks at the input. And so for my y vector will be 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, or 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, or 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, right? So a 1 of n representation. Wrong directory. Oh. Just for fun. This has nothing to do with the lecture. Which way is the cube turning? Do you get switching? Or are you looking at the cube from above or below? So look at it from above. All right, great. I love that one. It's going a little fast. All right, so what's being flashed here is the input. I've taken 28 by 28 images, and they're just real. There's a 784 dimensional vector, all right? And these are the actual outputs of the 10 perceptrons. And this is the desired output. So we're taking desired minus actual, and doing this, multiplying by the input vector and so on, and doing this perceptron update that I just showed you before. And it starts out from, so in this, on this right-hand side right here, I'm showing the weight vectors of the perceptrons, right? So remember, we have each perceptron is doing w dot x. Well, w is the same dimensionality as the image. So I can visualize w in the same way that I visualize an image. So let me just actually here is, this is actually a database consisting of 5,000 digits. It's available on the web, an AT&T website. And you can see there's a lot of variability. Right? It's a non-trivial pattern recognition problem to actually get something. I mean, look at this terrible. And that's pretty bad. There's lots of different versions of zero and so on. Okay. And when I first start out the perceptron learning, all the synaptic weights of the perceptrons are chosen completely at random, just a random number generator. And you'll see very rapidly they start to require some structure. So this is the classification. What's that?
In the weight for one of the
10 perceptrons. This is one. There's a 28 by. There's a square here. That's one perceptron. That's another perceptron, and so on. Can't really see. All right. So this is the one that's. This is being trained to be a one detector, a two detector, a three detector, and so on. No, this is really tabula rasa. I just 10 perceptrons. That's it. Taking that pattern right there. Very very simple minded. Well, clearly, well, not perfectly. But maybe we can find a W that works reasonably well. I mean, this is actually quantifying. Right now, it's 16% error. So clearly, it's doing better than chance. If it just guessed randomly, it would get 90% wrong. So that's the first epoch. It went through 5,000 examples, and I forget which. Yeah, so now it's down to about 12% error.
So you need as many neurons as pixels, right? I mean,
Well, there's 784 input neurons, and then there's 10 output neurons. That's it. 10 perceptrons. Okay, but you'll find there's a limit. So this is not actually a good measure of performance. I'm telling you 11%, but really to find out how well this does, I need to show it more examples from that it's not been trained on. And if you test it with examples it's not seen, its error will be higher than what you see right there. So I think if you train this for a long time, you'll get down to a test error on examples it hasn't seen before, something like 15-20%. So it's not that great. Indeed, the perceptron is such a simple architecture, it can't get to very low error on this task. Yeah, question? Alex? Or Carlos?
You're training where things will have an error. We start the training set.
There's a representational issue, right? Like if I trained the perceptron on XOR, it would always have an error because it can't represent XOR. We proved that. So in the same way, I can't be sure that that's true, right? It could be. There's two reasons why the error might be non-zero. One is that the true minimum of the energy might be non-zero, in which case there's no way that we can get lower than that. Or it could be that my algorithm for finding the right W is bad. I'm just not getting to the global minimum. But I think it's likely that there's just no. There is no W that will do it. What's that? Is it known? Yeah, I think it's known. You can actually verify it. So there are algorithms. So if I give you a set of points in high-dimensional space, and there is a plane that divides the positive examples and negative examples perfectly, then there is an algorithm that will always find that plane in finite time. So I could do that. What I could do is take these examples and apply this algorithm that's guaranteed to find a solution, if there is a solution, in polynomial time. And if it fails, then there is no such solution. So the standard perceptron algorithm, which is something like this, is guaranteed to converge in time less than infinity, which is not satisfactory. But you can turn it into a quadratic programming problem, I think, for example, or a linear programming problem. Right? It's a set of linear inequalities. So linear programming has polynomial time solutions. And so does quadratic programming for convex problems. So computer scientists can actually solve this if a solution exists. So if there is a zero-error solution, we could find it. But if there's a non-zero-error solution, if there's only a non-zero-error, finding the global minimum is, in general, that's a hard problem. Computer scientists cannot be... You talk to a computer scientist and they'll say, well, that's a hard problem in general. It might not have a polynomial time solution to find the true global minimum. Okay, so perceptron is fine, but we would like to... We can see here that maybe we're just being limited by the representational capability of the perceptron. Maybe we would like to add more layers. Like, we solved the XOR problem by adding more layers. So perhaps we could do that. And I'll just sketch how the algorithm works. I don't think I'll have time to derive it. So let me just diagram the network first. Imagine we have a network like this. So it has L plus 1 layers of neurons and L layers of synaptic weights. So XIL So take the network and give it this vector x super 0, and then use synaptic weight matrix W and this bias vector B to generate the activities in the next layer. Right? Just multiplication by a matrix, adding this vector, put through a nonlinearity, you get out the next layer. So if we were just doing perceptrons, we would stop here. But now we just keep on adding on more and more perceptrons. This is the multi-layer perceptron architecture. So evaluate this from L equals 0 to big L. So this is sometimes called the forward pass. Then there's the error computation. For simplicity, I'm going to call this quantity xi hat. So once I get to the last layer, the output layer of the network, I can compare the output layer with the desired output, the actual output with the desired output. That's this difference right here. Desired and here's the actual output. And then I have to multiply by this overall factor F prime, which you saw before in the perceptron algorithm also. So delta IL is some measure of error. And I can use that measure of error to adjust these weights. That's what I did in the perceptron algorithm. But now, how do I keep on adjusting weights that are further back? Because the error is only over here. right? What's the proper error to use in adjusting these perceptron's weights? So that's the problem of error propagation. How do I take error, an error signal that's over here, and turn that into an error signal I can use throughout this whole network? So speaking more broadly, one of the fundamental problem in learning in a large network is credit assignment, right? All of these perceptrons throughout this whole network, they all contributed to this output. Now let's suppose there's an error. How do we take that error and now use that to decide how to adjust every synaptic connection in this whole network? Right, that's a horrible problem, right? Suppose you're playing tennis and you hit the ball into the net. Somehow your brain has to adjust the synaptic connection. Now, who knows how many synaptic connections contributed to the ball ending up in the net? How does the brain decide how to adjust all those? That is one of the deepest problems in neuroscience, right? So this is a particular engineering solution that I'm going to tell you about for credit assignment. And it goes like this. So you take the error signals, delta, that are in the layer above, and there's a way of actually propagating them backwards through the network. So I'm taking the error signals in layer L, multiplying them by W, and deriving the error signals now in layer L minus 1. And so what's fascinating here is that this is called the backward pass, so this is the error computation. This is the backward pass. Or error propagation. And the fascinating thing about the error propagation is that it uses the same synaptic connections that were used in the forward pass, but it uses them backwards. So this is multiplication by the matrix W transpose. So it uses the synaptic weights backwards. Finally, once we've propagated the error signal throughout the whole network, we're in a position to make the synaptic weight changes. So to change the synaptic connection from layer L minus 1 to L, right? This is the matrix that takes you from layer L minus 1 to L. We look at the error signal in layer L and multiply it by the neural activity in layer L minus 1. So this is the generalization of the simple perceptron learning that I showed you before to the case of a network with many layers. We go up the network in the forward pass, compute the error, propagate the error backwards, and then wherever I see a synaptic weight, take delta here and x here, and use the product of delta and x to update the synaptic connection right there. All right, so what's fascinating? This is much more fascinating learning, actually, than the perceptron case, and I'll tell you why. It's because of the existence in this network of the so-called hidden layers. So we know what the input layer is because that's part of our training data. We know what we want the output layer to be because we have the desired outputs. But the network, in order to get from the input to the output, has to go through these intermediate representations. It has to find alternative representations of this information in each of these layers. And we're not explicitly telling the network how to find those, what they should be. The network is going to discover those from this training process. So I can show you a simulation of that also. So you can see that we've been letting this perceptron train, and it's gotten down to a training error of 6%, but still not down to zero. The synaptic weights have become less intuitive. It's not really clear what this network's looking for. Well, not always. 92% of the time it is, roughly. All right, you might ask, so before I told you that if I wanted to make a feature, I wanted to make a perceptron very selective for a particular pattern, I should just make the weights look like the pattern. So the question is, why doesn't the one detector have synaptic weights that look like a one? And why doesn't this have synaptic weights that look exactly like a two? There's some resemblance, but it's not perfect, right? And the reason is really discriminability, right? A lot of these patterns, not only do we want the one perceptron to respond well to ones, we want to make sure it doesn't respond well to, it should not respond to twos, threes, fours, fives, and so on. So that has some influence on what this pattern is right here. And one has, these various patterns, they all have some overlap on each other. They have some non-zero dot product. Okay, so this is a network that has 784 input units. It has 25 hidden units, and I'm showing the synaptic connections for each of the 25 hidden units as an image. And then from those 25 hidden units, it goes to 10 output units. So it has one extra layer than what I showed you before. So you can see that the initial stages of training this network are very slow, right? Unlike the perceptron actually very rapidly got better after seeing just a few examples, but this network doesn't get better. It's still at 88% error, close to random. It doesn't get better very quickly. And one of the reasons actually is because of a symmetry. So there's a permutation symmetry in this network, right? I can take any of those 25 hidden units and I can permute them with each other and I would get the same function back, right? So it actually takes a while, if you look at the dynamics of this training, this is some dynamical system, it takes a while to get out of this permutation symmetric phase. So initially all the perceptrons are trying to get better by all doing roughly the same thing. It's pretty slow. Random. As you can see, it's still pretty random.
Random in what range?
So there are lots of tricks of the trade. I think these were Gaussian random with a standard deviation of like 0.1. Often you choose the initial weight small, close to zero. So some kind of symmetry breaking is starting to emerge, right? The actual perceptrons start to acquire different feature selectivities very slowly. And what will happen eventually is that this will get down, it takes a long time, but this will get to much lower error than the perceptrons did. Presumably because this is a more powerful representation. It can represent a more powerful function. In practice, practitioners will just experiment. So they'll take 25, 50, whatever. They'll try out different sizes. There was a lot of work went into trying to find shortcuts to figuring out what the optimal hidden unit size is. But there's a lot of trial and error involved. Right. You could add more hidden layers. One of the rules of thumb is that is that, okay, so it actually classified a 1 reasonably well there, but the number of layers, one folklore is that if you have a lot of layers, this algorithm becomes slower and slower because it has to propagate that error signal back through all those layers. So people don't like to use a lot of layers. The network that I showed you actually did have a lot of layers, but some tricks were played in that network, so it was constrained. This is a so-called fully connected network. So every neuron here, in principle, starts out with synaptic connections to every neuron in the input layer. But remember that that other network had local receptive fields. Each neuron looked at a 5x5 patch. And then they had a constraint built in. Remember, there was this symmetry constraint that every neuron had to look for the same feature, but in a different position. So they had a deep architecture that was a very large network, in principle hard to train, but they added constraints to make it easier to train. So that's one of the tricks that people have found, trying to embed prior knowledge in terms of constraints on the learning problem. No, one layer is not right. One layer is not enough. You're saying is three better? You know, if
you said that, I mean, that's why by using one layer, we're going to hope to make a real.
Right, right. Okay, good. Well, it could be in the complexity of the network. It could be that if I use only one hidden layer, that hidden layer has to be a million neurons wide. But if I use two or three layers, I might be able to make that the width of the network decrease by quite a bit. So there can be advantages to having more than one layer, although I have to admit the mathematicians haven't really been able to characterize that too well in terms of the depth of the network.
What about the quantum information in the
right.
In the best neighbor, so
right. So the interesting thing here, remember, is that in the perceptron case, I was trying to make a 1 detector, 2 detector, and so on. Here, I'm not explicitly telling the network what to detect in this layer yet. The hidden layer is looking for some feature which is not explicitly specified in the training process. The network is trying to find the best features to look for to do this discrimination. And so one of the actual interesting lessons of artificial neural networks is inscrutability. If you actually look, imagine you're a physiologist and you took that network I showed you before, the one from AT&T Research, and you tried to measure the response properties of every neuron, you would find all kinds of weird things that you might, it's not clear whether you'd be able to explain them in any simple way.
Are you saying that these, if you actually do the comparison, can you find an analogy between this and the receptive field?
I don't know. So no one's ever done that. So that's a nice project, actually. I do have the synaptic connections for that, the Linet architecture, trained synaptic connections, and it would be interesting for someone to go and just probe them and see. At the early layers do look like orientation selective cells. At the higher layers, what does it look like? No one's really tried to do that analysis. But I suspect that it would be difficult to find. You might find some regularities. You might be like a physiologist, but it would be difficult to find a very simple explanation of how it is that Linet is able to do what it does.
Right.
And therefore, it will be simpler or more complex.
You don't know what would happen if you would try to train the network. So all the problems, maybe you would find some simpler features, because all the specialized features, which are good for some narrow problems, may not be good for other problems. So the only way to go would be to design some simpler.
That's right. So you're saying that the analogy between one of these artificial networks and a general-purpose vision device might be misleading. It's possible, but what I take away from this is how complex these simple things are. If you look at it.
Yeah, but this is what I'd like to say. It could be exactly because it tries to solve some very well defined problems in way of finding.
Yeah, but my suspicion is that it's more complex, that it's even worse in the real brain.
So has anybody tried to build a network to solve different kinds of problems?
Well, what makes you think that the brain is a general purpose? There is a lot of argument for modularity of brain function, right? That there may be a specific area in the brain that's specialized for face recognition, but not for recognition of other types of objects.
That's not the current view.
That is a current view.
Well, I don't know what you refer to, but this idea that you have face area and some building area.
Well, at least the face area. Okay, well, why is it that there are neurological patients who have lost the ability to recognize faces, but not to recognize other kinds of objects?
Or maybe faces.
Okay, maybe faces. So, is there a bicycle area? Is there, nobody knows, but.
Okay, but if there are bicycle areas.
Okay, so maybe faces are special, but it could be. It could be very compartmentalized. I don't know. No one's really looked for that level of fractionation. So, but my argument would be that the brain would be even more inscrutable than the artificial neural network.
But no, you say nobody tried to raise the density of the brain.
Not successfully. So these people concentrated on handwritten character recognition because it was a very simple vision problem. Faces are another kind of restricted domain, but general purpose vision, like to recognize any kind of chair or recognize any kind of bicycle from any angle, people are still pretty far away from doing that. I think people, you can program something that might perform dismally. You know, it might perform, I don't know, it depends on what your perspective, what your standards are, but 75% correct or something like that. But it's hard to actually get something that performs well, human-like performance. On a really hard problem. Yeah, question? Yes, we're in the discussion. That's right. Well, there's two issues. So one of them is whether the recognition computation is similar, and the other issue is whether the learning is similar. Right. So which one should I address? Whether the recognition is at all similar. Well, it's safe to say that nobody knows, but on the other hand, if I want to really be positive about this, I think that there is a lot of biological flavor to that network I showed you. Not this network, but the one I showed you this morning, right? It has this feature hierarchy, very simple features like bars at the bottom, complex features at the top, receptive fields that are increasing in size. And so selectivity is becoming more complex, and invariance is becoming more and more strong as you get up higher and higher in the network. So this network is not too far from the way that many neurophysiologists, like Hubel and Wiesel, would think about the visual system. Now, it leaves out lateral connections and top-down connections, any kind of feedback, right? But there is a kind of, the conservative kind of faction in the Hubel-Wiesel followers in neuroscience, that's the way they think about vision. I don't think it's that different. I don't know, Misha, would you?
I think when I there was a meeting on learning, when Jan Le Cun presented this kind of thing, some biologists were talking about
Let's actually bring it up again. So the issue of the computation, right, and then the idea of basically getting selectivity and throwing away positional information the way that people talk about complex cells, there's some resemblance. It's in some sense far away from biology, but there's some resemblance. The learning, I think, is farther away. It's not really clear that bat propagation is a useful way of thinking about this. And as Misha said, the earlier parts of this network or of our network should be a general purpose thing. Like when kids learn how to read, they're probably using a feature representation that they acquired already from a very early age that was general purpose for recognizing all kinds of objects. And then they learn how to recognize handwriting based on a representation that wasn't learned, was learned at a much earlier time. So the cost, the fact that we're relying on this purely supervised learning is probably just an engineering trick. And then at the physiological level, it's not clear whether bat propagation can be implemented. But on the other hand, I would be very happy if the nervous system could implement something like bat propagation. I doubt that the nervous system can do much better than gradient descent. On some cost function, gradient descent is pretty good, right? I doubt that it's looking, you know, it's probably not using simulated annealing to adjust the weights to actually. Simulated annealing, I think, is unlikely. Genetic, maybe some kind of selectionist thing, maybe, possibly. What's that? Are you talking about in somatic time or in multiple generations or? Okay, so there's learning through evolution, but I'm talking about just learning in the lifetime of a single individual. Yeah, clearly there's going to be some evolution component to this too, but yeah. Question?
Yeah, I think this morning you mentioned, or it's getting kind of fuzzy now. I'm getting over with it.
Okay.
You mentioned that a large fraction of the connections are actually backwards, at least by the
way. Right.
Something like maybe 95 number I remember.
No, I would say that if you look at layer 4 of the standard thing Rodney Douglas quotes is that layer 4 of primary visual cortex, where the LGN input comes in, that less than 5 or 10% of the synapses are from the LGN, and the most are lateral. Most are local connections. That's right. And this model has none. Exactly.
Backwards.
And there's backwards, too. So that's right.
And that probably complicates the learning algorithm a lot.
That's right. So one of the distressing things in the artificial neural network community is that not a lot of progress has been made in using recurrent networks. So if you believe that recurrence is so important for the brain, you would think it might be important in engineering. But if you look at the networks that actually had some practical applications, they were generally these feed-forward ones. Now, I agree with you, that's kind of strange, but that's what's happened in the engineering world. Yep.
What if the error is 0.8? Because I remember you started with 0.8, and since then the field is quite a structure, and it looks like it's getting much better.
You know,
the error in the thing.
Yeah. No, I think I changed this code so the error computation is wrong. Let's see. I've got a bug. What happened was that after a previous demo, a student asked me to change the simulation. I don't think I changed it back. Let's see the error computation. Actually, it's kind of fun to look at the code. So this is just setting up the size of the network, number of examples, learning rate. This is the initialization of the weights using a random number generator. The actual algorithm is this. So here's the forward pass, right? Two steps. Here's the error calculation, one step of backpropagating the error. Here's the weight update and the bias update. So this should be a max. So the student had asked me if I could choose a representation where it was all ones except for a zero. So I trained it up to that. I changed it back, but I forgot to change this thing right here. So that error. This number is the wrong number. You're right. Should we change that? Okay, we have to prevent it from reinitializing the weights. Okay, so that's more like it. The error here is 0.056, five. Good point. So this is now a proper error computation. So the training error is already at the perceptron level. It'll go even lower if we do a few more epochs. All right. So one of the things you see in artificial neural networks is that the solutions can be quite difficult to understand. And I think it's a kind of warning. It could be, the whole point of these problems is that there is no low complexity description. There is no very simple function that I can write down that will tell me how to do this pattern classification. Right? And in physics, we often try for these very compact theories, compact descriptions. But there probably is not a compact description. In the end, the result is still very complex. Now, the way out here, though, is very interesting, which is that the learning rule is very low complexity, right? I've got just a few equations for the learning rule, and they are able to generate this complexity. So it could be that the right way to understand the brain is to understand the rules that generate all that complexity, and it may be impossible to directly understand how every circuit in the brain actually works. So I'll just conclude there.